I had my thousands of serfs and plenty of all that men enjoy when they have the name of riches. But Zeus Cronion brought me to ruin, for that was his will, no doubt. Some day maybe you will lose all the finery which now marks you out from the others. Maybe your mistress will take offense and vent her anger upon you. Or Odysseus may come home, for there is room for hope still. But if he is really dead, if he will never come back, his son is here now, his son, Telemachus, by Apollo's grace, and like his father. He will not fail to see it, if one of the women takes liberties, for he is a man now.
Penelope heard this and scolded the woman. You may be sure, you bold girl, that I notice your impudence. You shall wipe it off on your own head. You know perfectly well I told you myself that I was going to question the stranger here in the hall about my husband, for I am sorely distressed. Then she called to the housewife, Eurynome, fetch a chair and lay a rug on it for the stranger. Let him sit there and tell his tale and listen to me, for I want to question him.
The housewife hurried off and brought the chair and the rug, and Odysseus patiently seated himself.
Then Penelope spoke. Stranger, she said, I will begin myself by asking you this question. Who are you? What is your country and your family?
Odysseus must have all his wits about him now. He began as follows. My lady, no one in this wide world could find fault with you. Your name resounds to the heavens, like the fame of a noble king, a God-fearing man who rules over a mighty nation and upholds justice, while the black soil yields him barley and wheat, his trees are heavy with fruit, the sheep wean their young unfailing, the sea provides fish, for he is a good ruler, and the people prosper under him. Then ask me anything else you will now I am in your house. But do not ask my family and my country and fill my heart yet more with sorrow when I remember. I am a man of many sorrows, but I must not sit grieving and lamenting in another man's house. Eternal lacrimation is a sorry occupation. The servants might not like it, nor you perhaps yourself. They might think me a drunken man, all afloat in tears.
Ah, no, said Penelope. All my comeliness and my good looks are gone. The immortals took them from me when the army embarked for the war and my husband with them. If that man would return and care for me, my name and fame would be better for it. But now I am in distress. See what trouble fate has poured upon me. All the chief men of the islands, from Dulichion and Same and woody Zacynthus, and all my neighbors in Ithaca, want to take me for a wife against my will, and they are wasting my house. So I take no heed of strangers or suppliants or public heralds with their messages, but I pine away with longing for my husband. These men are in a great hurry, but I wind my schemes on my distaff. First there was the shroud. Some kind spirit put it into my head to set up a web on my loom, a great web of my finest thread. Then I said to them, My good young men, you want me for a wife. Now Odysseus is dead, and you are in a hurry. But wait until I finish this cloth, for I don't want to waste the thread I have made for it. This is to be a shroud for my lord Laertes, when the fate of dolorous death shall take him off. I should be sorry to have a scandal among our women, if he should lack a shroud when he had all those great possessions. After that I used to weave the web in the daytime, but in the night I unraveled it by torchlight. For 3 years I kept up the pretense, and they believed it. But when the fourth year came round, the maids let out the secret, shameless things who cared nothing, and they came and caught me, and there was a great to-do. So I had to finish that, because I must, not because I would. And now I cannot avoid marriage. I cannot think of anything else to try. My parents urge me to marry and have done with it. My son chafes because they are eating everything up. He notices things now, and he is already quite man enough to manage a house which Zeus favors, with some credit. But never mind. Tell me who you are and where you come from. Your father was not a tree or a stone, as they say.
Odysseus answered, Much honored lady of Odysseus Laertiades, must you still ask my father's name? Well, I will tell you. Indeed, you will make me more wretched than I was, for that is the way of things, when a man has been away from his native land as long as I have, after wandering all over the world and suffering much tribulation. Well, never mind. I will tell you what you ask. There is a land called Crete, lying in the middle of the sea, with nothing but water all round it, and a fine, rich place it is. There are 90 cities. The people are infinite in number, and they speak different languages. Some are Achaeans, some are Ethiocretans, a proud people who claim to be the true Cretan stock. Some are Sidonians, and there are Dorians with long, flowing hair, and the splendid Pelasgians. One of the cities is Knossos, a great city where Minos, the 9-year king, held sway, who whispered sweet nothings in the ear of Zeus. He was the father of proud Deucalion, my father. Deucalion had 2 sons, myself and Prince Idomeneus, who went in the fleet to Ilion with the royal princes. My own name is known as Aethon, and I was the younger son. My elder brother was the better man. In that city I saw Odysseus, and entertained him in proper style. He also was on his way to Troy, but the force of the wind drove him out of his course past Malea to Crete. He escaped this storm with difficulty and managed to get into the dangerous harbour of Amnisus, where is the cave of Eileithyia. Then he went up to the city and asked for Idomeneus, who he said was the honoured friend of his family. But it was already 9 or 10 days since Idomeneus had sailed for the war, so I took him into my house and entertained him handsomely. I made much of him. I spared nothing of my own store, and I made a public collection of provisions and wine for his fleet, and fat oxen to their heart's content. They stayed with us 12 days, for they were kept there by a strong north wind. Even on shore they could not stand on their feet. The devil was in that wind. The next day the wind fell, and they sailed.
He made his long invention seem just like the truth as he told it, and her tears flowed while she listened. As the snow melts on the mountain tops, which the west wind has brought and the southeast wind has melted, and as it melts the running rivers are filled, so her fair cheeks melted, and the tears ran down in sorrow for the husband who was there by her side. Odysseus from his heart pitied his weeping wife, but he kept the eyes under his eyelids hard as horn or iron without a quiver, and stealthily hid his own tears. When she had enjoyed a good cry, she said to him again, Now I will give you a test, my good stranger, and see if you really did entertain my husband in your house, as you say. Tell me what clothes he wore, and what he looked like, and who was with him.
Odysseus answered, My lady, that is hard to say after all this time, for it is 20 years since he sailed away from my country. But I will tell you what I can see before my mind's eye. Odysseus had on a thick purple robe, doubled over. It was fastened by a brooch of wrought gold, with 2 sheaths for the pins. It had an ornament in front, a dog holding a speckled fawn in his forepaws and gripping his struggling prey. It was the wonder of all beholders how he gripped the fawn by the throat, and the fawn struggled with its feet to get free. Yet both were made of gold. I noticed the tunic your husband wore, glossy like the skin of a dried onion, and as soft. It shone like the sun. The women could not take their eyes off him. But, of course, there is this to consider. I don't know whether Odysseus wore that dress when he left home. Someone may have given it to him on board, or some stranger, for Odysseus had many friends, and few of the nation were his equals. I gave him myself a sword and a good folding cloak and a tunic with a fringe. I showed him all possible respect before he departed. Yes, and he had a herald with him, a little older than he was,
I will tell you what he was like. He was round-shouldered, dark-skinned, and curly-headed, and his name was Euripides. Odysseus paid him greater regard than any of his companions, because he was an honest, faithful man.
How well she knew the things which Odysseus described so exactly. She wept again, and when she had enjoyed another good cry, she spoke to him again. "I was sorry for you before, sir, but now you shall be my friend and my honored guest in this house. I gave him those clothes myself, just as you described them, folded them up and brought them out of the storeroom, and put in that sparkling brooch to please him. But I shall never welcome him again to his home and his native land." It was an evil day when Odysseus entered the ship which was to carry him to that accursed city which I cannot bear to name.
Odysseus answered, "Honored lady, do not let the tears spoil your beautiful face. Do not break your heart for your husband's loss. Not that I wonder at it, not at all. Many another woman mourns the loss of the husband of her youth, the beloved father of her children, even if he was one very different from Odysseus, a god among men as they describe him. Calm yourself, for I have something to tell you, and I will tell it truly, without reserve. I have heard that Odysseus is already near home, in the Thesprotian country, alive with a heap of treasure which he has collected on his travels. But he lost his ship and all the crew on his voyage from the island of Thrinacia. Zeus and Helios were angry because his men killed the cattle of the sun, and so they were all drowned in the deep sea. But he was saved on the ship's keel and cast up on the Phaeacian shore. The people of that country are near akin to the gods, and they treated him with a god's honor and heaped their gifts upon him. Indeed, they were ready and eager to bring him home safe and sound. Odysseus would have been here long ago, but he thought it better to go farther and gather more before he returned. You know, Odysseus is a man full of schemes, always ready to gain an advantage beyond anyone in the whole world. There never was his match. I will tell you what Phidon, the Thesprotian king, told me himself. He swore me an oath with solemn ceremony in his own house that he had a ship launched and a crew ready to see him safe home. But before that happened, I came away in a ship of theirs which chanced to be sailing for Dulichium. Phidon showed me all that Odysseus had collected. There was treasure belonging to him in the king's palace, enough to keep his sons for 10 generations. The king said he had gone to Dodona in order to hear the will of Zeus from the great oak, how he was to manage his return after his long absence, whether to come openly or secretly. And so, your husband is safe, and he will come soon. He is very near, not far away, and it will not be long before he returns. I will even swear it upon my oath. Zeus first be my witness, and this hearth of Odysseus where I take refuge. Verily, all shall come to pass as I declare. This very Lichgang, Odysseus will be here, when the old moon is waning and the new moon is rising.
Then the faithful Penelopea replied, I pray that this may indeed come to pass. Then you would soon see that I am your friend, and you would be rewarded so as to make anyone envy you. But it is too good to be true. My heart tells me that Odysseus will never return, and you will not have my help on your way. For there is no such master now in this house as Odysseus was when he was alive, as sure as ever he was alive, ready to honor a guest without fail, to welcome his coming and to help him on his way. Now then, you maids, wash his feet and lay a bed with blankets and rugs that he may sleep warm till the golden dawn. And in the morning, after a bath and a good rubbing down, let him go in with Telemachus and do justice to a good breakfast in hall. If any one of those men vexes him with his brutality, it shall be the worse for him. He shall not do any good to himself. Let him fret and fume as he likes. For how can I show you, my guest, whether I am any better than other women in sense and judgment, if I let you sit down dirty and shabby in my house? Short is the span of a man's life,
If anyone has an unkind heart and acts unkindly, all men call down curses upon him while he lives, and when he dies, all men give him an evil name. But if there is a blameless man with a blameless heart, guests and strangers carry his fame abroad through all the world, and many call him blessed." Odysseus answered, "Honored lady, rugs and blankets are hateful to me ever since I sailed across the sea from the snowy mountains of Crete. I will lie now, as I was used to spend my sleepless nights, for many a night have I spent on a rough bed waiting for the dawn. I care nothing for washing of my feet. No woman shall touch a foot of mine, none of all the servants in your house, unless there is some old woman you can trust, someone who has suffered as much as I have. I would not mind her touching my feet." Penelope replied, "My dear guest, no one so discreet as you has ever come to my house of all the visitors who have come from foreign lands. All that you say is right and true, and could not be better. I have an old nurse, a worthy, sensible woman, who nursed that unhappy man and dandled him in her arms as a baby. Indeed, she took him from his mother when he was born. She shall wash your feet, although there's little strength left in her hands. Come here, Eurycleia. Get up, you clever old dear, and wash your master's years, mate. I should not wonder if Odysseus has hands like his and feet like his. Men quickly grow old in evil days." The old nurse covered her face with her hands and burst into tears as she cried in lamentable tones, "Well away, my love, and what can I do for thee? Zeus must have hated thee more than any man alive for all thy God-fearing mind. Never a mortal man so careful to do his service and sacrifice to the Lord of Thunder. And all I prayed for was to live to old age in comfort and bring up his fine son. Ah, but now God has robbed him of his return, alone among them all. The women would mock at him also in foreign parts when I came to a stranger's door, just as these bitches all mock at thee, sir. And that's why thou'd not let em touch thee with their flouts and jeers. But I'm reet willing to do what my lady bids me. I will wash thy feet indeed, for my lady's sake, aye, and thy own sake too, for I'm strangely moved. Listen now, think of this. Many a wayworn stranger has come to these doors, but I do declare I never set eyes on one so like my master as thou beest, looks and voice and feet and all." Odysseus answered, "True, mother, that's what everyone says who has seen us both. We are very much like each other, as you have noticed yourself." The old woman brought a basin and half filled it with cold water, then poured in hot water and got ready to wash his feet. But Odysseus quickly moved away from the fireplace and turned his back to the light, for he had just remembered something. He was afraid she might touch the scar of an old wound, and everything might come out. This was a wound made by the tusk of a wild boar. Odysseus had gone up to Mount Parnassus to visit his mother's father, Autolycus, and his family. Autolycus was one who could cajole any man alive on his bodily oath. A god gave him this faculty, the god Hermes himself, for he won the god's favor by his burnt offerings of sheep and goats, and therefore the god was glad to befriend him. Autolycus came once on a visit to Ithaca and found his daughter's son a newborn baby. As he was finishing supper, Eurycleia laid the child on his knees and said, "Do you think of a name, sir, to give their daughter's son? Indeed, he is a child of many prayers." Autolycus answered, "My son and my daughter, I will tell you what name to give this child. I have been at odds with many in my life on Mother Earth, both men and women. Let his name, then, be the man of all odds, Odysseus, for I promise you that when he grows up and comes to visit his mother's home on Parnassus, where I have a great house full of wealth, I will give him some of it and send him home happy." That was the reason why Odysseus paid that visit, to get those promised gifts. Autolycus and his sons greeted him with hand-claspings and friendly words. Amphithea, his mother's mother, threw her arms round him and kissed his head and his two beautiful eyes. Autolycus called out for dinner, and his sturdy sons lost no time in bringing a 5-year-old bullock. They skinned it and carved it up and put the pieces neatly upon the spits, broiled the meat to a turn, and divided the portions. Then they spent the rest of the day in feasting until sundown, and everyone had a good share. When the sun set and darkness came on, they went to bed and enjoyed the blessed gift of sleep. As soon as the first rosy fingers of dawn showed through the mists, they sallied out to the hunt, men and dogs together, and Odysseus went with them. They climbed the forest-clad hill of Parnassus, and soon came into its breezy valleys. The sun had risen out of the smooth surface of the deep-flowing ocean, and it was just touching the fields when the huntsmen came to a glade. The hounds were in front, casting for a trail, and the sons of Autolycus behind. Odysseus was close upon the hounds, with a long spear in his hand. There in a dense thicket lay a great boar. No damp wind was strong enough to blow through that thick scrub. The blazing sun could not pierce it, nor rain drip through, and the ground was buried deep in leaves. The boar was aroused by the trampling of men and dogs. Out he came from the bushes and faced them, his neck bristling and his eyes flashing fire. There he stood close to them, and Odysseus, in front of the rest, ran at him, pointing the spear to deal him a blow. But the boar charged sideways and struck him first above the knee. The tusk glanced off the bone and cut a long gash through the flesh. Then Odysseus got home on the right shoulder, and the sharp blade ran right through. The boar fell with a grunt and died. The young men looked after Odysseus and bound up the brave boy's wound with care and skill. They stopped the blood with a charm and brought him back at once to their father's house. Autolycus and the sons of Autolycus nursed him and cured him, and sent him away happy with a heap of handsome gifts to Ithaca. His father and mother were glad to see him again, and asked about the wound. He told the story at length, how he had gone hunting with the young men, and a boar had torn him with his tusk. All this passed through the mind of Odysseus, as the old nurse touched him with the palm of her hand, and felt the scar. She knew him, and dropped the leg which fell in the basin with a clang, so that all the water was spilt. Joy and sorrow together filled her heart. The tears rose in her eyes. Her voice choked, but she touched his chin and said, "Surely thou'rt my baby, and I never knew thee till I had felt my master all over." As she said this, she looked towards Penelopea, eager to show that her beloved husband was there in the house. But Penelopea noticed nothing, for Athena had turned her mind far away. Then Odysseus caught hold of the woman's throat with his right hand, and with his left he drew her closer, as he whispered, "Nanny, do you want to destroy me? You nursed me at your own breast, and now, after sore tribulations, after 20 long years, I have come back to my native land. Well, since you have found me out, and that is the will of God, silence. Not another soul must know. Or I tell you plainly, and I will do it too, if God grants me to master these violent men, I will not spare even you, my nurse, when I kill the other women in this house." The faithful old woman answered,
"Love, what a thing to say. Thou knowest my temper, stubborn and stiff. I'll be as hard as stone or iron. And, hark a minute, when thou'st downed those lordly manymequicks, I'll tell thee over all the women in the house, which of them besmirch ye, and which are innocent."
Odysseus said, "Why will you talk of them, Nanny? There is no need of that. I will take note of every one of them, and find out for myself. You keep a quiet tongue, and leave the rest to God." The old woman went out to get some more water, for it was all spilt. When the washing and rubbing was done, Odysseus drew his seat nearer the fire to warm himself and pulled his rags over the scar. Then his faithful wife began to speak. "My guest," she said, "there is another thing I will ask you on my own account, for it will soon be time to rest, if anyone is not too unhappy to enjoy the sweet boon of sleep. But my lot is infinite mourning. All day long my only pleasure is tears and sorrows, while I look to my work in the house and the servants. And when night comes and the others take their rest, I lie in my bed with a throbbing heart, while sharp cares torment me in my sorrow. You know that bird of the green wood, who was once the daughter of Pandarus, now the nightingale. How lovely is her song in the early springtime, how she sits perched among the thick leaves of a tree and pours out her full notes with many a trill. She is mourning for her dear boy Italus, King Zethus' son, whom she killed one day herself with a knife and knew it not. So my heart is torn in two. I ask myself, shall I stay with my boy and keep all safe, my possessions, my women, and this great towering house? Shall I respect my husband's bed and the people's talk? Or shall I cast in my lot with the best man who offers himself and brings a handsome settlement? So long as my son was a child and careless, he kept me from marrying and leaving my husband's house. But now he is a great boy and quite grown up. See how he begs me to go back where I came from, because he is anxious about his inheritance, which these people are eating up. But please, listen to my dream and say what it means. There are 20 great geese about the place which come out of the water to be fed, and it warms my heart to watch them. But a great eagle from the mountains swooped down and broke their necks with his curving claws and killed them. There they lay in a heap on the ground while the eagle soared up into the sky. I shrieked and cried aloud, I mean, in my dream, and a crowd of women gathered about me as I wept bitterly because the eagle had killed my geese. Back came the eagle again and perched on the free end of a roof beam and spoke to me with a human voice. Take courage, thou daughter of far-famed Icarius. This is no dream, but a waking vision of good, which will surely be fulfilled. The geese are those who woo thee, and I, who was lately an eagle, am now come as thine own husband, and I will bring a dreadful death upon them all. Then I awoke, and peering about I saw the geese as usual beside their trough, pecking away at the wheat corns. Odysseus answered, My lady, it is impossible to interpret the dream in any other way, since you see Odysseus himself has told you what he means to do. Death is there for your wooers plain to see. They shall all die, and not one shall escape. Penelope said, The truth is we don't know how to deal with dreams. What they tell is uncertain, and they do not all come true, for there are two different gates which let out the shadowy dreams. One is made of horn, one of polished elephant's tooth. The elephant's tooth is full of untruth, so that any dreams which there come through never come true. But carven horn is ne'er forsworn, and if anyone has a dream which came by that gate, it tells him the truth. Now, I fear this strange dream did not come through the gate of horn. If it were so, welcome indeed it would be to me and my son. And I must tell you something more which I wish you to bear in mind. The evil day is about to dawn which will cut me off from the house of Odysseus. For I mean to set up a contest. Those axes which that man used to set up along the hall like trestles for a ship's keel, 12 in a row, and then he would stand a good way off and shoot an arrow through. This is the contest I will set up for the company. Whoever shall most easily bend the bow with his own hands and then shoot an arrow right through the 12 axe heads, I will cast in my lot with him, and I will leave this house of the husband of my youth, this noble place full of abundance, which I think I shall still remember ever in my dreams. Odysseus answered, Noble lady, put off no longer this contest in your house, for Odysseus will return here, ready for all events, before these men shall handle the bow and string it and shoot through the iron heads. Penelope spoke once more and said, My guest, if you would be willing to sit beside me in this hall and comfort me, no sleep would ever fall upon my eyes. But mankind cannot do without sleep altogether. and the gods have given each thing its place in the life of mortal men on Mother Earth. Well, I will go up to my chamber and lie down once more upon my bed. Indeed, it has been a bed of tears for me, ever since Odysseus left me to visit accursed Ilion, which I can hardly bear to name. I will lie down there, and do you lie somewhere in the house. Put your things on the ground, or let them lay you a bed. So saying, she went up to her chamber, and the two waiting women went with her. Then she lay down, mourning still for her dear husband, until Athena cast a deep sleep on her eyelids. Book 20. How God Sent Omens of the Wrath to Come. Odysseus made his bed in the forehall, an undressed oxhide with a pile of sheepskins on it. The sheep had gone down the throats of the uninvited guests. Eurynome tucked a cloak round him, and he lay there wide awake, pondering his plans of vengeance. He heard the women go out giggling and joking to pair off with their lovers as usual. He felt as fierce as a bitch standing over her litter of pups, snarling and growling at someone she does not know and ready to fight. So his heart growled in him at their shameless ways. For a while he did not know whether to kill them all or to let them go for the last dalliance of their lives. But at last he rated his heart with grim humor. "Patience, my heart. You have been in a worse mess than this, when Goggle-Eye gobbled up my companions, the savage beast. You were patient then until my machinations got you out of that den where you expected to die." His heart came to heel like a hound, patient now until the end, but his body kept tossing from side to side. He might have been a good fat black pudding going round in front of a blazing fire while the cook basted it on the spit to roast it quickly. As he rolled over and over, thinking how he could get his hands on that shameless crew, one against many, Athena came down from heaven and stood by his side in the shape of a woman, saying, "Why are you wakeful, poor fellow? This is your house. Your wife is here in the house, and your boy, such as anyone might be proud to have for a son." Odysseus answered the vision, "Yes, that is true, my goddess, that is quite right. But what puzzles me is this: how can I get my hands on this shameless crew, alone, by myself? They always come here in a crowd. And there is another thing worse than that. If I could kill them by the help of Zeus and yourself, how could I escape the blood feud? I pray you, tell me that." Athena said, "Incorrigible. Many a man trusts a weaker friend, a mere mortal who has fewer ways to help. But I am a god, and I always protect you in all your dangers. I tell you plainly, if 50 battalions of mortal men stood round us determined to kill, even so, you should drive off their flocks and herds. Come, come, sleep away. All this watching and waking tires a man out, and you shall soon be free of your troubles." While she spoke, his eyelids drooped in sleep, and the goddess returned to Olympus. But while sleep held him fast, and as it soothed his heavy limbs, soothed also his heavy heart, his faithful wife awoke. She sat up on her bed weeping, and when the tears brought some relief, she prayed aloud to Artemis. "Artemis, queen and goddess, daughter of Zeus, pierce my heart with an arrow now and let me die. Or let the storm wind snatch me up and carry me through the air and drop me at the mouth of the rolling ocean stream. Did not the storm wind carry off Pandaro's girls? The gods destroyed their parents, and they were left orphans. But Aphrodite fed them with cheese and sweet honey and delicious wine. Hera gave them beauty and good sense above other women. Holy Artemis made them grow tall. Athena taught them skill in women's work. Then Aphrodite went to the Olympian heights and made her petition to thundering Zeus, for he knows all things, both what is fated for men and what is not. She begged Zeus to arrange a happy marriage for the girls. And while she was there, the snatchers snatched them away and delivered them to the cruel avengers to look after. If only the Olympians would make away with me so, or if Artemis would pierce me with her arrows, let me once more see my husband before my eyes, and then be laid in the earth with my sorrow. But let me not gladden the heart of a lesser man. Sorrow can be endured even when the days are passed in tears with a broken heart, so long as sleep comes in the night. For sleep brings forgetfulness of all things, both good and evil, as soon as the eyelids close. But I am haunted by cruel dreams. This very night one like him slept by my side, just as he was when he left me that day. And how glad my heart was! I thought it was no vision of my dreams, but flesh and blood at last. As she said this, the day dawned in a golden glow. Odysseus heard her sorrowful voice, and in his dreamy half-consciousness he seemed to see that she knew him and stood by his side. He gathered up his bedding and took it into the hall, where he laid it upon a chair. Then he carried the oxhide into the courtyard, and, lifting up his hands, prayed to Zeus. O Father Zeus, if it has been the gods' good will to bring me home over sea and land after visiting me with sore afflictions, let one of those now awakening in this house speak a word of meaning, and here, without, let Zeus give me a sign. Zeus, all-wise, heard his prayer. At once came a thunderclap from radiant Olympus out of the clouds on high and brought joy to his heart. The word of portent came from a woman grinding corn in the mill-house close by. 12 women used to keep the millstones rolling, to grind wheat-meal and barley-meal, the marrow of men's bodies. The others had ground their portion and gone to sleep. But one was still at it, the weakest of them all. Now she stopped her millstone and gave the sign which her master prayed for, crying out, O Father Zeus, King of kings and Lord of lords, there was a great thunderclap out of a starry sky with not a cloud to be seen. Truly this is a sign from heaven for someone. Then hear the prayer of a miserable woman like me. May this day's breakfast be the last breakfast these men shall ever eat. See how they have worn me out with heartbreaking toil to grind their barley. Now may this be their last meal. Odysseus was glad to hear the words of omen and the clap of thunder. Now he felt sure he should punish the guilty men. The other women were busy now in making up the fire on the hearth. Telemachus rose from his bed and dressed. Then he slung the sword over his shoulder and slipped his lissom feet into his boots and took a good sharp lance in hand. And as he came out of his room, he called to Eurycleia, Nanny dear, how did you look after the stranger? Had he bed and food, or was he left to shift for himself? That's mother's way, though she is sensible enough. She makes no end of a fuss of one man, and sends another away with contempt. But the better man gets worse treatment. The wise old woman answered, Now don't the go to blame when there's no blame due. He sat down, he drank his wine as long as he liked, and said he wasn't hungry, for she asked the question. When he turned his mind to sleep, she bade the maids lay a bed for him. But not he. Said it was used to roughen it, wouldn't lie on bed and blankets, but slept on a raw cowhide and sheepskins in the forehall. We tucked him in with a wrap. On hearing this answer, Telemachus went through the house, still holding the spear, and his 2 dogs went dancing about him. He passed out on his way to the marketplace, and Eurycleia called to the maids, Wake up, lassies! Get to work and sweep out the place and sprinkle it. Lay the purple rugs on the seats. Some of you wipe over all the tables with your sponges and wash out the mixing bowls and drinking cups. Some be off to the spring for water, and don't dawdle on the way. The company will soon be here. They'll be early enough today when they're all keeping holiday. The maids were not slow in obeying. 20 of them set out for the spring, and the rest made the house tidy. The men-servants now came in and chopped wood. By and by the maids came back from the spring, and after them the swineherd with 3 of his best fat pigs. He left the pigs feeding in their sty, and asked Odysseus quietly,
Stranger, are the people looking after thee better, or are they as bad as ever?
Odysseus answered, May God punish them for their outrageous doings in another man's house. They have not a scrap of shame in them. As they were talking, Melanthius, the goat-herd, came in with his best goats for dinner. Two underlings were with him. He tied up the goats under the porch and at once began railing at Odysseus.
"I see you're going to be a nuisance again with your begging, man. You had better get out while you can. I surmise that we two shall not part without a taste of fisticuffs, for you play the beggar without rhyme or reason. Are there no other dinner tables in the town?"
Odysseus made no answer. He threw back his head in silence and brooded on the wrath to come. A third man now joined them, Felicius, an excellent fellow, bringing a farrow cow and some fat goats. They had come across by the public ferry. He tied up his animals under the porch and, turning to the swineherd, said,
"Who is this stranger come to our house, swineherd? What is his nation and family? Where does he come from?"
"Poor man, looks like one of the real quality, but surely the gods do plague unhappy mankind when they spin out trouble even for the quality."
As he said this, he offered his hand to Odysseus in greeting, and went on,
"Welcome to thee, father, and good luck to thee in days to come. Just now thou'rt far from happy. Oh, Father Zeus, thou art most cruel of all gods. Men are thy offspring, but thou hast no pity for them to bring them acquainted with pain and tribulation. I fell of a sweat when I saw thee, and the tears came into my eyes thinking of the master. I doubt not he's dressed in rags like thine, and wandering through the world, if he is still alive and sees the light of the sun. But if he is dead and gone, alack-a-day for my good master, who set me over the cattle in Cephalenia when I was a slip of a boy, and now they breed a fair miracle. Else how could a man see the broad-faced beast sprouting up like stalks in a wheat-field? But these foreigners make me drive them in for their eating. They care not a jot for the young master here in the house. God's wrath doesn't make them tremble. What they mean is to parcel out all his goods forthwith now the master is away so long. I keep turning it over in my mind. It's a bad job while the sun is alive to march off with my cattle to another country and foreign masters. But it fairly makes a man sick to stay here and look after the beast with foreigners laying down the law. A wretched life. I'd have made off long ago and taken service with some other squire, for life's not worth living here. But I can't help thinking of the poor master, who might come back, who knows, and make a clean sweep of the lot of them.
Odysseus answered,
"Drover, you seem an honest fellow and no fool, and I can see myself that you know what is right and proper. Therefore, I tell you, and take my solemn oath upon it, Zeus be my witness, and this hospitable table, and the hearth of Odysseus, to which I have come for protection, that you will be here when Odysseus will return, and you will see, with your own eyes, the death of those wastrels who lord it in this place."
The drover replied,
"May Cronion bring it to pass, stranger. Then thou'st know what my strength is, and how my hands play up."
While they were talking thus, the pretenders were discussing how they could murder Telemachus. But they spied a bird on the left, an eagle flying high with a trembling dove in his claws. So Amphinomus said to the others,
"My friends, this plan will not run smooth, this death for Telemachus. Never mind, don't let us forget our dinner."
This suited them all very well, and they went in. They made the seats and benches comfortable with rugs, and some of them killed the great sheep and goats, others killed the fat pigs and the cow. They broiled the tripes and chitterlings and sent them round. They filled the mixing bowls with wine. The swineherd served the cups. Bread was brought in baskets by the excellent Felicius, and Melanthius poured the wine. So the company fell to. Telemachus carefully chose a place for Odysseus and put him within the great hall beside the doorstone, with a ramshackle old chair and a small table. He provided him with a plate of tripe and a gold mug full of wine, saying aloud,
"Sit there now among the gentlemen and drink away. I will protect you from rudeness and violence, for this is not a public place but my father's house, and he got it for me. So I request you, gentlemen, to control your tongues and your hands if you wish to avoid a quarrel.
It astonished them all to hear this bold language, and they bit their lips. But Antinous spoke to his friends.
"That's a rough way of putting it, men," he said, "with a plain threat. But we had better put up with it. Zeus would not allow us, or we should have silenced him by this time and heard the last of his oratory."
Telemachus took no notice. All this while the public heralds had been leading the sacrificial victims in procession through the streets, and the people were gathering in the shady grove of Archer Apollo. In the house of Odysseus they had broiled the flesh meat and served it up. There was a famous feast for them all, and Odysseus himself had the same share as the others by order of his son Telemachus. But Athena intended to provoke Odysseus yet more, and she would not let the intruders abate their outrageous doings. One of them was a lawless ruffian named Ctesippus, who came from Same. No doubt he trusted to his huge fortune in paying court to the lady of Ithaca while her lord was so long away. This man saw his chance and called out,
"A word in your ears, my bully lads, just a moment. This stranger has had his due share already, like the rest of us, but I will add a parting gift so that he may be able to tip the bathman or the servants in this lordly hall." And picking up a cow's foot out of the basket, he threw it straight at Odysseus. But Odysseus saw it coming and dodged it neatly by a slight movement of the head. Bang went the hoof against the wall, and Odysseus smiled grimly to himself. But Telemachus said ironically, "That was a good notion of yours, Ctesippus, to miss him so neatly. But stay, I see he dodged it himself. If not, I would have run you through with my spear, and your father would have been burying you instead of marrying. So I warn you all not to indulge in violence here. I am no longer a child, but I see what goes on and know all about it, both good and bad. We have to put up with this kind of thing, sheep slaughtered and wine guzzled and bread swallowed down, because it is hard for one to control many. But I beg you to stop all this malicious damage. If you really mean to kill me outright, I should prefer that. It would be much better to die than to look on every day at violence. Strangers knocked about and women dragged all over the place in this indecent way." They had nothing to say to this, but after a long pause, Agelaus Damasterides said, "My good friends, that is quite fair and proper, and no one has any right to object or feel annoyed. Leave the stranger alone, and all the servants in the house of my lord Odysseus. But I should like to say something, with all due respect, to Telemachus and his mother, and I hope they will take it in a friendly spirit. So long as any real hope was left that Odysseus would return home, there was no harm in waiting and refusing those who offered themselves in marriage. That was much the best thing, if Odysseus did return and put in an appearance. But now it is clear that he will never come. Just sit down and have a quiet talk with your mother. Tell her to take the best man who offers, and the most liberal, that you may enjoy your patrimony in peace and plenty, and someone else may give her a home."
Telemachus answered,
"I swear to you, Agelaus, by Zeus and by the sorrows of my father, whether he be dead or wandering somewhere far from Ithaca, that I do not try to delay my mother's marriage. Indeed, I beg her to take whom she will, and I offer any amount by way of dowry. But I should be ashamed to lay down the law and turn her out of doors if she does not want to go. God forbid."
The gallants roared with laughter to hear this and could not stop, for Athena had sent their wits astray. But the laugh turned into a grimace. And see, their plates were messed with blood. Tears streamed from their eyes. Their minds foreboded mourning. Theoclymenus, the seer, cried aloud, "Ah, miserable creatures, what is happening to you? Night is wrapped about your heads and your faces and your bodies down to the knees. There is a blaze of lamentation. Tears roll down your cheeks. Walls and panelings are bedabbled with blood. The porch is full of phantoms. The courtyard is full of phantoms. Hurrying down to Erebus and the dark, the sun has perished out of the sky, and a thick fog spreads over all."
They laughed loudly to hear this,
And Eurymachus said, "The stranger is dazed because he doesn't know our part of the world. Look sharp, young fellows. Take him out and show him the way to the marketplace, since he thinks it is night here." But Theoclymenus answered, "I didn't ask you for guides, Eurymachus. I have eyes and ears and a good pair of feet, and my mind is all right, nothing wrong there. They will help me out of this place, since I can see woe coming upon you, which not one soul shall escape out of all those who frequent this house, maltreating men and plotting violent deeds." So saying, he walked out of the house and made his way to Piraeus, who welcomed him gladly. But the gallants laughed and nodded and began to tease Telemachus about his guests.
"My dear Telemachus, there never was anyone more unlucky in his guests. First you hunt up this vagrant and bring him in. All he wants is something to eat and drink, can't do a stroke of work, could trail a pike. He's just a burden to the earth. And here's another, gets on his feet and plays the prophet. If you follow my advice, it will pay you. Let's bundle the pair of them into a ship and send them off to Sicily, where they will fetch a good price."
So they railed, unabashed. But Telemachus took no notice of their talk. He looked to his father in silence, biding his time till he should get his hands on the shameless crew. Penelope had put a seat opposite the door, and she heard all that was said. Laughing and talking, they got ready for their meal with victuals of the best in plenty after slaughtering all those animals. But no supper could have been more unpleasant than that which a goddess and a strong man were soon to set before them in return for their unprovoked machinations. Book 21. The Contest with the Great Bow. You remember Penelope's plan to bring her husband's great bow into the hall, and the axes, and to propose a shooting match. Death was the prize, though they knew it not. Now she climbed the stair to her room and got out the key of the storeroom, a fine key of bronze with a curving catch and an ivory handle. She passed on with her waiting women into the innermost storeroom where her husband's treasures were kept, bronze and gold and wrought iron. There was the great bow, with a double back-springing curve and a quiver full of arrows. All these his magnificent friend Iphitos Eurytides had given him when they met once in Lacedaemon. And this is the story. They met in the house of Ortilochus in Messene. Odysseus had come to demand reparation from the Messenians, for the Messenians had lifted 300 sheep out of Ithaca and carried them off in their ships with the shepherds. So Odysseus was sent as public envoy all that long way when he was quite a youth by his father and the alderman of Ithaca. Iphitos was in search of a dozen brood mares which had been lost along with their mule foals. In the end, these were the death of him when he came across that mighty son of Zeus, that grand fellow Heracles, a champion if ever there was one. But Heracles entertained him as guest and then killed him in his own house. A hard man he was, who cared nothing for the wrath of God or the table of hospitality, so he killed the owner and kept the mares for himself. Iphitos was inquiring for these mares when he fell in with Odysseus and gave him the bow. His brawny father Eurytus used to carry it, and he left it to his son when he died. Odysseus gave him a sharp sword and a strong spear to mark the beginning of their friendship. But they never sat together at table, for Heracles killed Iphitos too soon for that. He was a great noble who gave that bow. Odysseus never took the bow with him when he went to war across the sea, but he carried it in his own country and treasured it in memory of a well-loved friend. Those were indeed arrows of sorrow, which Penelope came to fetch. So the lady came to the storeroom door. There was the wooden threshold, planed and polished so skillfully by the craftsman, and made straight to the line. There were the doorposts and the pair of shining doors. Quickly she unfastened the thong from the crow-latch, then ran in the key, dropping the prongs exactly into their holes, and shot back the bolt. What a crashing and creaking there was when the key hit the bolt, and the doors flew open. You might have thought it was a bull bellowing in a meadow. She stepped upon the high platform where chests were standing full of scented stuffs.
She reached up to the peg and took off the bow in a shining case. Then she sat down and laid it across her knees, weeping bitterly as she handled her husband's bow. But after she had enjoyed a good cry, she descended to the boisterous company in the great hall, holding in her hand the bow and the quiver with its arrows of sorrow. The attendants followed, carrying the tray with the master's iron gear for the contest. Penelopea stood by the doorpost of the great hall, holding her soft veil in front of her cheeks, and spoke out before them all. "Hear me, you proud men that seek my hand, you who have laid siege to this house, eating and drinking day after day all this long time, while my husband has been absent, and not one word could you say for yourselves but that you wish to make me your wife. Now then, here is the prize before your eyes, and here I lay my noble husband's bow. Whoever shall be able most easily to string the bow with his own hands and shoot through the openings of 12 axes set in a line, he shall win me. I will leave this house of my young married days, so fine and so full of all good things, which I think I shall always remember, even in my dreams." Then she called Eumaeus and told him to carry round the bow and iron stuff. Eumaeus took the bow from his mistress, and tears came into his eyes as he laid it down. Tears came into the drover's eyes where he stood as he saw his master's bow. But Antinous rated them both and said, "A couple of foolish bumpkins who can't see tomorrow from today. You wretches, why do you blubber and harrow your lady's feelings? She has trouble enough as it is, losing her husband. Sit down quietly to your dinner, or if you want to cry, go outside and leave the bow here to settle our rivalry once and for all. For I don't think it will be easy to bend that fine bow. There is not a man in all this company as good as Odysseus. I have seen him myself, and I remember him well, although I was only a boy." That is what he said, though he really expected to bend the bow himself and to shoot through the line of axes. But he was to have the first taste of an arrow from Odysseus, the very man he was dishonoring at that moment, and egging on the others to do the same. At this Telemachus burst out wildly, "Upon my word, Zeus Cronion has made me crazy. Here is my dear mother, a model of propriety, going to leave this house and take another man, and I just laugh and enjoy it like a born fool. Come along, then, hearties. Here is your prize before your eyes, a woman who has not her equal in the whole country, not in Pylos or Argos or Mycenae. But you know that already. What's the good of praising my mother? Come along. No shilly-shally. Don't hang back. String the bow and let us see. I think I will just have a try myself. If I can string the bow and shoot a bullseye, I shall not mind it a bit if my honored mother leaves the house and goes off with someone else, when I am left behind quite able to handle my father's gear." Then he stood up and threw off his purple cloak and the sword from his shoulders. First he drew a long trench in the floor, straight to the line, and set up the axes, stamping down the earth to hold them. All were surprised to see how neatly he did it, although he had never seen them before. Then he returned to the doorway and tried the bow. 3 times he moved the upper end forward as he strove to string it. 3 times he gave up. He felt sure he could bend the bow and shoot the shot, but when he had tried the 3rd time, Odysseus made him a sign, and he desisted much against his will. Then again the brave lad said, "Bless my soul! I shall turn out to be a weakling and good for nothing, or perhaps I'm still too young, and I cannot yet trust my hands to defend myself if someone attacks me. Come along, you stronger men, have a try at the bow, and let us finish this game." With these words he put down the bow, leaning against the polished panels of the door, and stood the arrow against the tip of the bow. Then he sat down again. Antinous said, "Come up in order, all of you, from right to left, beginning at the place where the man is serving the wine." They did so. And the first man who came was Leodes, their diviner, the son of Wineface Enops. Leodes, who always sat up at the very end of the hall beside the great mixing bowl, he was a man who hated all kinds of violence and resented their doings. He was the first to take up the bow and arrow. He stood at the threshold and tried the bow, but he could not bend it. His soft, unpracticed hands soon grew tired as he pulled and pulled, and he said at last, "I can't bend it, my friends. Let someone else take it. This bow shall destroy many a strong man, since it is better far to die than living to miss that which brings us all here together, waiting and waiting, day after day. There is many a man here now that hopes and desires to wed Penelopea, but when he has seen and tried the bow, let him woo some other woman of our nation and pay his court with gifts. Then the lady will take the man who offers most, the man who has the luck." Then he set the bow leaning against the door and placed the arrow against the tip and returned to his seat. But Antinous rated him roundly.
"I never heard such a thing, Leodes. Dreadful nonsense, I call it, and it makes me angry.
So this bow shall destroy many a strong man just because you can't bend it? The fact is, your respected mother did not produce a son fit to draw bows and shoot arrows. We shall soon find someone else who is man enough to do it." Then he called to Melanthius, the goatherd. "Hurry up, you, light a fire in hall, and put a good big seat near it with a fleece to sit on, and then fetch a good chunk of fat from the pantry. The young fellows can warm the bow and grease it well, and then we'll finish our game." Melanthius lost no time in lighting the fire. He set the seat in place with its fleece and brought out a good chunk of fat from the pantry. The young men warmed the bow and had their try, but no one could bend it. They were far too weak. Antinous and Eurymachus kept them hard at it. These two were the ringleaders. Meanwhile, the drover and the good old swineherd had gone out together, and Odysseus followed them. As soon as they were outside the gate of the courtyard, Odysseus began to speak to them quietly. "You, drover, and you, swineherd, I have something to say to you. Or shall I keep it to myself? My mind urges me to speak. What would you do to defend Odysseus if some providence brought him here, if he should turn up all of a sudden? Would you side with Odysseus or with the others? Tell me the honest truth." The drover answered at once, "Oh, Father Zeus, if only thou'd grant this blessing, if only some god might bring that man home at last, thou'd know then, sir, the strength of my hands." So also Eumaeus prayed to all the gods of heaven that they might bring back Odysseus to his native land. Odysseus now saw that they were both honest men, and he spoke again and said, "Here I am, in my house, my very self, after sore tribulation, after 20 years, returned to my native land. I see that you, too, alone of all my servants, welcome my coming. I have not heard one other pray that I might return. I promise you both, on my honor, and I will keep my word, if God shall destroy all these men by my hands, I will find wives for both of you, and give you land and well-built houses close to myself, and you shall be friends and brothers of my son Telemachus. And now I will show you something to prove manifestly who I am, and show that you may trust me. Here is the wound which the wild boar made when I went that time to Parnassus with the sons of Autolycus." Then he drew back his rags and showed the scar. They examined it closely, and then they threw their arms round his neck and burst into tears, kissing and fondling his head and shoulders. Odysseus also kissed their heads and hands, and they might have gone on till sunset, but he checked them and said, "That is enough. No more weeping and wailing now, or someone may come out and see us and tell them inside. Go in, one at a time, I first and you after. Let this be your signal. They will all refuse to give me the bow and quiver, but you must come down the hall, Eumaeus, and put the bow in my hands. And afterwards, go and tell the women to bolt the doors of their rooms, and if they hear any noise or tumult of men where we are, not to come out, but stay where they are and mind their own business. You, my dear Felicius, lock the courtyard gate and fasten it with cords as quick as you can." Accordingly, he went back to the hall and returned to his seat, and the two others came in after him.
By this time Eurymachus was handling the bow and warming it all round at the fire. But even so he was not able to bend it. He uttered a deep groan of annoyance and called out,
"Upon my word, I am sorry for myself and for everybody. It is not so much the wedding, though I am sorry enough about that. There are plenty of women to be had in Ithaca and elsewhere. But to think that we can be so much weaker than Prince Odysseus, that we can't bend his bow, that will be no credit to us in future generations."
Antinous answered, "That's all nonsense, Eurymachus, and you know it. Today is the feast and holiday of the great god in our town. Who would trouble about bending bows today? Put it aside and never mind. As for the axes, they may be left here. They will take no harm. I don't think anyone will march into the hall of my lord Odysseus and pull them up. Come along, let the man pour in our drops. Let us honor the gods and put away bow and arrows. Tomorrow tell the goat-herd Melanthius to drive down his best goats, and we will offer the rump slices to Apollo and his bow, and try again at this bow, and finish our game."
All were glad to agree. The marshals brought water for their hands, the boys filled the mixing bowls to the brim, and served wine to all in due form. When the ceremony was done, and they had eaten and drunk all they wanted, Odysseus spoke according to his secret plan.
"May I be allowed to speak to the gentlemen who are here paying court to the noble lady? But I address myself especially to Eurymachus and my lord Antinous, since he said the right thing just now to put away the bow for the present and leave the rest to God. Tomorrow God will give the victory to whom he will. But I beg you to give me the bow, and let me try the strength of my hands. Let me see if my muscles are as strong as they once were, or if all my strength is gone through wandering and hardship."
This made them all very angry indeed, for they were afraid he might succeed in bending the bow.
Antinous gave him a sound rating.
"You wretched stranger, you must be out of your mind. Aren't you satisfied to dine unmolested in the company of gentlemen and have all you want to eat? Must you listen to our conversation? No other beggar or stranger listens to our conversation. The wine's too good for you, that's it. Wine plays the mischief with anyone who opens his mouth too wide and swallows too much. Wine fuddled the famous centaur Eurytion when he visited the Lapiths in the hall of Pirithous. When his wits were fuddled with wine, he went mad and raised a riot in the hall of Pirithous. The guests leapt up in anger and dragged him out and cut off his nose and ears. So, with his fuddled wits, away he went, hag-ridden by his own folly and fuddledom. From this came the feud between centaurs and men, and he brought punishment on himself first by getting drunk. So I prophesy great trouble for you if you bend that bow. You will find no mercy in our town, but we will send you off to Ketchum Ekitos, the bogey king who chops men up, and no one will save you from him. Sit quiet and drink. Don't quarrel with younger men."
Penelopeia answered him, "Antinous, it is not right or fair to deny any guest of Telemachus who may come to this house. If this stranger is strong enough to bend my husband's bow, do you suppose he will take me home and make me his wife? I do not imagine any such thought ever entered his head. None of you need be anxious on that score, for indeed it would be most improper."
Eurymachus answered,
"Make you his wife? No, my dear Lady Penelope, we never supposed anything so absurd. It was the thought of men and women gossiping. If some common fellow should say, 'A lot of second-rate specimens went to marry the wife of a real gentleman and can't bend his bow, and here comes a beggar on the tramp, bends it easily and shoots straight to the bull's-eye,' well, that sort of thing would get us a bad name."
Penelope replied, "Eurymachus, no good name is possible for those who dishonor the house of a prince and devour his wealth. Then why do you think such a trifle would get you a bad name? This stranger is a fine, well-built man, and he says his father was a man of birth and rank. Just give him the bow, and let us see. I tell you plainly, and I will keep my word, if Apollo grants him the honor of bending the bow, I will supply him with an outfit of good clothes, and a spear to keep off dogs and men, and a sharp sword, and boots for his feet, and I will help him on his way wherever he wishes to go."
Telemachus now put in a word. "My dear mother, no one has a better right than I to give the bow to whom I will or to refuse it. No great noble of Ithaca or of the islands along the coast, not one of them, shall compel me against my will, even if I wish to present the bow and arrows to my guest and let him keep them. I beg you to retire to your rooms. You have your own work, loom and distaff, and the servants to look after. The bow is a man's business, and mine in particular, for I am master in this house."
Penelope was surprised, but she admired his spirit and went back to her room, thinking what a man he had become. Upstairs, with her waiting women, she spent the time in lamenting her lost husband, until, by grace of Athena, she fell into a sound sleep.
Now the swineherd had taken up the bow, but as he was carrying it along, there was a great outcry among the intruders, shouts and protests. "Where are you taking that bow, you crazy swineherd? Confound you! Your dog shall tear you to pieces all alone among your pigs. You bred them, and soon you shall feed them, if Apollo and all gods are gracious to us."
The swineherd dropped the bow on the spot. He was terrified by all these men shouting at him.
But Telemachus called out from the other side in a threatening voice, "Daddy, take that bow along! Soon you'll be sorry if you listen to these people, or I'll chase you out into the country with a shower of stones. I may be younger, but I am stronger. I wish I were as much stronger than all these gentry. I could soon send them out of the house in a way they wouldn't like, for they are a wicked lot."
This made them all laugh heartily and put them into a better temper. So the swineherd carried the bow along and put it into the hands of Odysseus. Then he went out and called Eurycleia, the nurse, and said to her,
"My good Eurycleia, the young master says thou must shut the doors of your rooms, and if anyone hears any noise or riot where we are, they must not come out, but mind their own business."
She did not understand the meaning of his words, but she shut the doors of their quarters. Quietly, Philoetius ran out and locked the courtyard gate. There was a strong ship's hawser under the porch, and he used this to fasten the gate. Then he came in again and returned to his seat, with his eyes ever on Odysseus. By this time, Odysseus was handling the bow, turning it round and round and feeling every part, to see if the worms had got into it while its master was abroad. The others were watching him, and one would say with a look at his neighbor,
"He seems a bit of a bow fancier. He knows the points of a bow. I wonder if he has things like that at home. Maybe he thinks of making one. See how he handles it and poises it, the clever old rascal."
Or another, again,
"He's welcome to all he'll get by stringing that bow."
Amid all this talk, Odysseus balanced the bow and scanned it over.
Then, as easily as a skillful musician stretches a new string on his harp, fastening the sheep gut over the pegs at each end, so, without an effort, Odysseus strung the great bow. Then he took the bow in his right hand and twanged the string. At his touch, it sang a clear note like a swallow. The gallants were dumbfounded, and their skin paled. Zeus gave a loud thunderclap, a manifest sign, and Odysseus was glad that after all his troubles Zeus had shown him a portent, Zeus, the son of Cronos, the master deceiver. He took one sharp arrow which lay out on the table before him. The others were still in the quiver, but those present were soon to feel them. This he laid on the bridge of the bow, and drew back the string and notches together. Still sitting upon his chair as he was, he took aim and let fly. He did not miss. Right through the tops of all the axes went the shaft, and clean out at the other end. Then he turned to Telemachus and said, "Telemachus, your guest is no discredit to you. I wasted no time in stringing the bow, and I did not miss the mark. My strength is yet unbroken, not as these men taunt me in their scorn. But now it is time to prepare supper for the company while the light lasts. After that there will be time for other sport with music and song, for these are the graces of a feast."
Then he signaled with a nod to Telemachus, and Telemachus slung on his sharp sword and grasped his spear and took his stand by the seat, the son armed by his father's side. Book 22. The Battle in the Hall. Now Odysseus stripped off his rags and leapt upon the great doorstone, holding the bow and the quiver full of arrows. He spread the arrows before his feet and called aloud to the company. "So, the great game is played. And now for another mark which no man has ever hit. I will see if Apollo will hear my prayer and let me strike it." Then he let fly straight at Antinous. He was holding a large golden goblet in both hands and about to lift it for a drink. Bloodshed was not in his thoughts. Who could imagine at the festal board that one man amongst many, even if he were very strong, would bring certain death upon his own head?